that you would want to consider when you are planning for and ultimately designing a database availability group for high availability or for site resilience. We're going to be talking about both, actually. And as you can see, we've got a pretty lengthy agenda. We're going to be talking about some design examples. I'll show you some pictures of some very basic designs and walk you through some of the features of those designs. Then we'll get into the various areas that you need to consider, things like Active Directory, things like your network, things like certificates, namespaces, and so forth. And then we'll wrap up with talking about DAG member policies as well. So we are going to talk about several areas, but as I said, all of the areas directly relate to designing a solid database availability group for your organization. So let's start out with some example designs, starting with the most basic DAG that you can have. And since, by the way, database availability group is a lot of words to say, so instead of saying that, I'm going to just use the acronym DAG, D-A-G. So when you hear me say DAG, I mean database availability group. So when you look at this picture, this is the smallest DAG that you can create, a two-server DAG. Okay, so if you're a small organization and you want high availability, the smallest DAG that you can create is one that contains two Exchange servers. And this is a very basic representation here. We've got multi-role servers, so they're running mailbox, client access, and hub transport all on the same server. And we're replicating databases between both servers. If you're coming from Exchange 2007, this is pretty different from cluster continuous replication. In cluster continuous replication, you had one of these servers that was all active and another server that was all passive. In this model, in the database availability group model, you can combine active and passive databases on the same server. And that's, in fact, what we're doing here. The legend shows you that these green databases are your active databases. These blues are the passives. So I've got the active copy of DB1 running on this server and a passive copy being kept up to date and maintained by that server. Now, some other things you want to be aware of with this solution. This does enable redundancy of all three primary Exchange server roles with a minimum of two physical Exchange servers. But you will still need a third physical or virtualized server somewhere to act as a witness for this DAG. So no matter what high availability solution you choose, no matter what the design, there's always going to be a minimum requirement for three physical servers. In this case, one of the other caveats is because we're running mailbox and client access on the same server, the mailbox is part of a DAG, which has an underlying Windows failover cluster in it. You cannot combine Windows failover clustering with Windows network load balancing. And so what that means for the load balancing solution, that will have to be a non-Windows load balancing solution. But there are many choices for that. That could be a hardware load balancer. That could be a virtualized load balancer. It could be any software-based non-Windows load balancer and so forth. But you have the caveat where you cannot mix NLB with failover clustering. So if you do this design where you have multi-role servers in a DAG, you would have to use some other load balancer other than Windows network load balancing. So as I said, this is a very basic example. Moving up to a slightly larger example, this is a four-member DAG. And because it's a four-member DAG, it has some differences over a two-member DAG. For one thing, it has greater resiliency because it's a larger DAG. But for another, because it's larger, it allows me to have many more copies of my databases. So for example, here's my active copy of DB1, but I've got a passive copy of DB1 here, here, and here. The one in orange is a special copy. That's called the lagged copy. It's not a highly available copy. It's meant for disaster recovery. Think of it as a point-in-time copy that can go back as far as 2 weeks. And that's something that we have built into the system. So for those of you who want to take advantage of a system-created point-in-time copy rather than taking a traditional backup, you now have that built into Exchange. Some other differences with this solution is because you can deploy four copies, we believe that's enough copies of the data to allow you to skip traditional protection mechanisms such as a backup and such as using RAID. So what that means is in this solution, I don't need to back up any of my databases, and I don't need to use expensive RAID arrays and RAID controllers for the storage underneath my databases. And instead of using RAID, I have the option to use JBOD. That's an acronym that means just a bunch of disks. In other words, it's disks that don't use RAID. And so that means the solution will be much less expensive than a solution that uses RAID, that has a RAID controller, that buys more expensive storage, that uses backup software, that has to manage the backups and so forth. So this solution ends up saving costs in the long run simply by virtue of the fact that you can deploy more copies. So the more copies of your data that you have, also the greater the resilience that you have. Now, here's another interesting DAG. This one is different from the others. Each of these two previous ones were all located in a single site. All of the members of the DAG were in one Active Directory site. In this example, we now have a DAG that is extended between two Active Directory sites, Redmond and Portland. This DAG also has some other differences. It does have these mailbox servers in it, but it also has these other servers in it that, although it's not clear from the picture, in this design, PDX Hub 1, Red Hub 2, and Red Hub 1 are members of the DAG, and they are mailbox servers, but in this design option, these servers don't host any databases. These are what we would call voting-only DAG members. In other words, we've added more mailbox servers to the DAG so that we can increase the number of members and the number of votes that we have to maintain the underlying quorum for the failover cluster. And this is something that's optional. This isn't something that we would necessarily recommend for all customers for a couple reasons. First, to do this, obviously to add a mailbox server to a DAG, it has to be running the enterprise version of Windows. That's a more expensive version of Windows. It also ends up being a mailbox server that pretty much doesn't get used as a mailbox server. It ends up just being a quorum voter. But for some organizations, they want that greater resilience. They know that the more members I put into my DAG, the more failures I can survive and the greater uptime I get. So this does become attractive for some customers, not all, but some customers. Okay, let's start going through all of the design principles, and typically the first question that we're going to be talking about is sizing your DAGs and choosing the number of DAGs. There's one takeaway here that's more important than anything else, and that is the larger the DAG, the greater the resilience. Now, in case you're not aware, I mentioned it a couple times, but underneath every DAG is a Windows failover cluster. Windows failover clusters use the concept of quorum in order to determine whether or not the solution can stay up and run or if the solution needs to be terminated. As long as the solution has quorum, it'll stay up and run. If the solution loses quorum, it will terminate and all of the databases will dismount. You lose quorum when you lose a majority of voters in the DAG. And therefore, the greater the number of voters that you have, the more voters that you can lose and still maintain majority. So larger DAGs inherently provide greater resilience because they can survive more server failures while still maintaining quorum and keeping the solution up and running. So our recommendation, when you want to know how many servers you should put in your DAG, is to go big. Put in as many as you can. There is a limit of up to 16 servers for each DAG. Many customers don't hit that limit. Most customers end up with maybe 4, 5. Some hosting customers might end up with 10, 12, or maybe even go to 16. But the enterprise customers are going to have a much smaller number. But if you're wondering, should I have 2 3-member DAGs or 1 6-member DAGs, go for the 1 6-member DAG because the larger DAG provides you greater resilience. And it's just basically a math exercise. It's talking about the loss of voters. The other recommendation we have is that we want you to have the server count be a multiple of your database copy count. So if you know that you're going to want 3 copies of database 1, then you want a server count to be a multiple of that. So you'd use either 3 servers or 6 servers or 9 servers and so forth. If you knew you were going to have 4 database copies, you would use 4 servers or 8 servers or 12 servers and so forth. That recommendation comes about because that makes the design symmetrical, and it makes it much easier to manage and to deploy when you have the ability to deploy up to 100 databases per server in a DAG that can contain up to 16 servers. Okay, so when you have the possibility to deploy 1,600 databases, you want a more sensible way of doing that, and the symmetric approach is typically the best approach. So another question that comes along is, how many DAGs should I deploy? The real answer is, it depends. We know that the DAG is limited to 16 members, so if you need to deploy more than 16 mailbox servers, you might be deploying more than one DAG. You can only have 16 mailbox servers in one DAG. Of course, you can have many, many DAGs in your environment. You can have 1,000 DAGs in your environment if you needed to. I don't think there's anybody that does yet, even us in Office 365, but you could if you wanted to. The other question is, what is your domain architecture? All mailbox servers that are members of a DAG have to be in the same Active Directory domain. And by domain, we mean the actual domain. We can't use a parent domain and a child domain. It has to be the same AD domain. So if you've got multiple domains into which you need to deploy mailbox servers, you may be deploying multiple DAGs for that reason. And then the third reason has to do with administration. If you have separation of administration, where some administrators might be responsible for servers, say for example here in Moscow, where other administrators might be responsible for servers somewhere else, St. Petersburg for example, you may have separation of administration that you need to consider, and using multiple DAGs can help you with that as well. We do have a permission subsystem called role-based access control inside of Exchange 2010 that does allow you to control who has access to things within a DAG, but it's not going to be as true of a security separation as using separate DAGs would be. So those are the primary reasons. There may be other reasons as well, depending on your site resilience architecture. And we'll talk about that in a few moments when we get to that slide. But generally, these are the reasons that would drive you towards deploying more than one DAG in your organization. So let's talk about Active Directory. How many of you are familiar with Microsoft's official guidance as to when you should deploy a single Active Directory site or multiple Active Directory sites? Okay, if your hands didn't go up, it's okay. And the reason is, up until literally just a couple months ago, we had no such guidance. The guidance didn't exist. And it does now. It's at that URL. And it basically states that if your connectivity between the Active Directory sites is roughly 10 milliseconds or less, then we would want you to consider a single Active Directory site. There may be other reasons that push you to multiple Active Directory sites, but 10 milliseconds ends up being our boundary. Okay, so be aware that this is generally brand new guidance. You may have heard this guidance before. Somebody at Microsoft may have given it to you, because we've been telling this to people for a long time, but we've never documented it until now. Now it's finally documented, and we've incorporated it into our guidance for DAGs. The reason Active Directory sites are important are because when you look at the client access server and you look at the hub transport server, the functions of those servers are largely site aware. They prefer to service mailbox servers in their local site. So the local client access service generally talks to the local mailbox servers. Yes, it can talk to mailbox servers across the WAN, but generally it's designed to service the local mailbox servers. Same with hub transport. Hub transport will only deliver messages to and receive messages from mailbox servers that are in its local site. If it needs to get a message to another Active Directory site, it must send that message to a hub transport server that is in that other directory site. Okay, so that's an important distinction between CAS Hub and the way they play with Active Directory sites. They don't always focus just on the single site, on the local site, but primarily their focus is that local site. Okay, let's talk about namespaces, because namespaces are important, and they are different from how we used to do it in previous versions of Exchange. Exchange 2010 especially in a site resilience environment, the namespace model is very different from what we had in previous versions. In previous versions of Exchange, even Exchange 2007, for example, when you had a site resilient architecture, you didn't necessarily need live services and a live namespace in your secondary or your backup data center. You certainly needed them in your primary data center, but you did not need them in your backup data center. In Exchange 2010, however, you do. Exchange 2010 is different from the other versions because it assumes that any site it's extended to has live running services, Active Directory, DNS, namespaces, etc., all live and functioning at all times. And this is different. This is a very subtle change over previous versions of Exchange. The reason for this change is, unlike all previous versions, we now have the ability in Exchange 2010 to take a single mailbox database and have that fail over or switch over to another Active Directory site on its own. Okay, so that's different. In 2007, we were moving an entire clustered mailbox server back and forth to do that. The clustered mailbox server no longer exists. Now it's just database level failover, and because we have the ability for a mailbox database to move on its own to another Active Directory site, you need to have the supporting namespaces and Active Directory and networking infrastructure in that other site in order to support it. So there are more design considerations for a site resilience environment than we had in previous versions of Exchange. Each data center is going to be considered active even if you don't have users in all the data centers. So that means each data center is also going to need its own set of namespaces, a namespace for Outlook Anywhere, for Exchange Active Sync, for Exchange Web Services, maybe for POP and IMAP if you're using those protocols, a namespace for SMTP, and of course one of the data centers will also host the AutoDiscover namespace as well. Now, there are a lot of different namespaces that are listed, but you can generally, in most cases, end up using the same fully qualified domain name for all of those different namespaces. You don't have to have a separate FQDN for each namespace that you want. If you want everything to be mail.company.com or mail.whateveryourdomainis.com, you can do that for all of your namespaces. The point is, though, they have to be live and different in each data center. Additionally, in Service Pack 1, we added one more namespace. It's called the Failback URL. And that is a namespace that is specific to a data center switchback scenario where you've activated a secondary data center and now you're switching back to the primary data center and you need to deal with name caching inside of the web browser. That's where that namespace comes from. If you're not deploying a site resilience environment, you don't need to worry about the failback URL namespace at all. But if you are deploying a site resilience environment, and more importantly, if you've activated your backup data center and then you want to swing back to the primary data center, you will need that failback URL to help your users make that transition. Our other recommendation around namespaces, and again, we're just talking about fully qualified domain names here, or the URLs that users use to access their mailbox, is we recommend using what we call split DNS. In other words, that's using the same host names both inside the corporate network and outside on the internet, but you use different IP addresses. So if I'm inside the corporate network and I choose mail.contoso.com, I'll resolve to an IP address that points to the virtual IP on my load balancer inside my organization. If I'm outside coming from the internet and I put in mail.contoso.com, that's going to resolve using external DNS, and it's going to resolve to the IP address on my reverse proxy that's sitting outside my corporate network. But the benefit here is that, first, users only need one URL. You just say, wherever you are, inside or outside, go to mail.contoso.com and you will get your email. You don't have to say, oh, if you're outside, go to corp.contoso.com or inside, go to local.contoso.com. It's just one namespace. They don't have to remember different URLs. It also makes it simpler from a certificate perspective, as you'll see in a minute as well. So minimize the number of host names that you use and use split DNS so that you have the same host names internal and external, just obviously resolving to the proper endpoints. So what does something like that look like? So here's a site resilience environment where we've got Moscow as our primary data center, St. Petersburg as our backup data center. And if we look at the namespaces that we see in external DNS here, they're the same namespaces that we find in internal DNS with a couple exceptions. There's a couple extra that we have internally that you wouldn't see externally. But generally, it's the same exact name. But here, if I'm outside the internet, mail.contoso.com is going to put me here on my reverse proxy. Inside mail.contoso.com is going to resolve ultimately to the load balancer that's sitting in front of my CAS servers. Now, the other thing that you want to notice is over here, we've got namespaces for this data center as well, but it's different from the namespaces we're using here. So these are live data centers, so they have to have separate namespaces. Now, this is just an example, the mail.sp, sp for St. Petersburg, .contoso.com, that's just the random example I chose. You can use any other namespaces that you want here, it just has to be unique for that data center. So this is one example. Some customers use geographic locations in their namespaces. Some use numbers. Some use other identifiers. Whatever makes most sense for your company, that's what you should use. But keep in mind, the namespaces that you use here are going to be different from the namespaces you use here. Okay, let's talk about certificates now. Who enjoys working with certificates? Really? You enjoy it? Wow, okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that because a couple years ago when we were building Exchange 2010, when we still had Exchange 2007, we got feedback from some customers, including an MVP, who related to us that working with certificates in Exchange was about as much fun as poking your eye out with a spoon. Okay, so that tells you how bad it was in 2007. We did a lot of work in 2010. We added a certificate wizard into Exchange in 2010 and some new user interface elements to show you your certificates and make it much easier to use. So you don't have to go out to a third-party site like DigiCert and use their wizard, which is where we sent it everyone in 2007 timeframe. So now certificates have gotten a lot better. And in fact, our guidance around certificates have been a lot clearer now too. Our overall goal for you with respect to certificates is to minimize your costs. Okay? Why? Certificates cost money. Okay? And you want to reduce the amount of money that you spend because you want to keep costs of the solution as low as possible. So the idea in minimizing the number of namespaces or minimizing the number of host names that you're using plays into a reduction in costs for your certificates. So here what we're recommending is generally use one certificate everywhere. Get one certificate that's exportable with a private key, and then import that on all your client access servers, all your hub transport servers, and all your reverse proxy servers, and if you're using them, all of your edge transport servers as well. Now, it is a little bit more expensive to get a certificate that can be exported and used on multiple machines, but it's not as expensive as getting separate certificates for each machine that you need, so you'll still save money by going down this path. But again, you're minimizing the number of host names and therefore minimizing the cost for that certificate as well. We also strongly recommend that you use a subject alternative name or SAN certificate. The reason you want to use a SAN certificate is because it supports multiple host names. Now, there's also another kind of certificate that supports multiple host names, and that's called a wildcard certificate. Wildcard certificates are supported by Exchange, so a wildcard certificate would be something like star.microsoft.com. So anything.microsoft.com could be secured using that certificate. But we don't recommend wildcard certificates. And in fact, there will never be a wildcard certificate issued for Microsoft.com. The reason for that is security. If that certificate is lost or stolen, it gets into somebody's hands, they can use it to spoof any name at your domain. So obviously, we wouldn't want that to happen. We wouldn't want somebody spoofing the Microsoft download website or the TechNet website. So we would never issue a wildcard certificate for Microsoft.com. Generally, we don't recommend customers do that either, although we do support them because there are some customers who have them in use. but we do strongly recommend the SAN certificate because although that supports multiple host names, it's only supporting the specific host names that you have added on that certificate. It's not a global wildcard certificate that can support any name. So it limits your exposure there, even though it may have multiple names on it. One of the other caveats is that Outlook Anywhere, if the principal name on the certificate does not match the URL that users are using for Outlook Anywhere won't connect to their mailbox. It will pop up a certificate error message, and even if they click OK and say, yes, I accept the certificate problem, Outlook still will not connect for them. So you want to make sure, once you get your certificate, that you correctly run the set Outlook provider commandlet and configure the Outlook Anywhere provider so that it does use the proper name. And typically it's going to be MSSTD colon and then the namespace that you give for Outlook Anywhere. If you're not familiar with this, MSSTD is just short for Microsoft Standard. So it's a Microsoft Standard format for that URL. All right, let's talk about user distribution models. So generally, when you think about it, there's really two types of models that you'll take into account when you're doing your design. One is the namespace model, which we've already talked about. The other is the user distribution model. And by that, we mean, where are your users located? If you have a single data center and all of your users are in that one data center, it's easy. You don't have any work to do. But if you have multiple data centers, then you've got a decision to make. Are all of your users in a primary data center and the other data center's just empty, it's a backup, a disaster recovery type data center? Or do you have users in a primary data center, but you also have a whole lot of users in another data center as well? How are things distributed? That's an important decision design point because the way in which you deploy a DAG across multiple data centers can directly affect availability for one or more of those data centers. So let me show you what I mean by that. Over here on the left, we have our primary data center. Over here, we've got our secondary data center. I've got my DAG here. It's got four mailbox servers, and it's extended between data centers, two here and two here. This is my WAN connection. Because this DAG has an even number of members, it also is using a witness server, which is this server outside the DAG right here. And so what's going to happen if I lose the WAN link here? Remember, going back to the discussion we had earlier about the need for quorum. If you don't have quorum, the solution terminates. When we lose the WAN link, that severs communication within the DAG. These two servers end up being cut off from the rest of the solution, the rest being mailbox A, mailbox B, and the witness server. So what ends up happening is these two servers lose quorum and they terminate. Now, if you had a bunch of users here, these users are now out. They cannot access their mailboxes anymore. Okay? You would have to either give them another connection so that they could go through the internet to access their mailboxes, which are going to be active here now, or you'd have to do something else. What's the something else? The something else is two DAGs. And the way this works, it's basically a mirror of the first one. The first one, remember, going back, it's just one four-member DAG with the witness server over here in the primary data center where we would presume the majority of the users are. Whereas in the two DAG, it's basically a mirror. So DAG one, here's its two members here, and its witness server. DAG two members here, and its witness server here. So now, same scenario, we have a WAN failure. What happens in this case? Yes, the passive side loses quorum and terminates, but each side still has an active portion of one of the DAGs running. And so they still have access to their local mailboxes, even if the WAN goes down. Okay? So that is a key design element. If you've got users in both data centers and you want to provide resiliency in the event of the WAN connection going down, the only real solution for that is multiple DAGs. A single DAG cannot do that for you because anytime a single DAG is severed from network connectivity, part of that DAG is going to lose quorum and terminate. So to prevent that from happening in what we call the active user distribution model, you would use two DAGs configured similar to what you see here. All right, let's talk about something outside of the DAG now called the RPC Client Access Server Array. And this is something new that we introduced in Exchange 2010. And it could be a little confusing for some people because sometimes we just refer to it as a CAS array, which is still accurate, but it's misleading. Because when people hear CAS array, they start thinking an array of CAS servers that's going to service Outlook Web App or Exchange Active Sync or POP and IMAP. And although CAS does service all those clients, the RPC CAS array does not. And that's why I point out its true name, which is RPC Client Access Array. RPC Client being Outlook, and more importantly, being Outlook inside your corporate network. So the RPC Client Access Array is the new connection endpoint, basically, for all domain join Outlook clients that are on the corporate network. That is what that array is used for. And the array itself is just an object. It's just an object containing all of the CAS servers in that site. And what you need to do is put a load balancer in front of that array, and then the load balancer handles the load balancing of the traffic across all of the CAS servers in that array. So that's a new requirement. That's a requirement we've never had in Exchange before, the requirement for a load balancer inside your corporate environment. So yes, that will increase the cost of the solutions because you're buying something you haven't bought before, but overall the solution itself should be less expensive than anything that you've deployed before. But either way, whether you have a single CAS server or multiple CAS servers, we always recommend that you create the RPC Client Access Array. The reason for that is every mailbox database has this property called the RPC Client Access Server property. The value of that property is either a single CAS server or the CAS array in that site. If you don't create the RPC CAS array, then every single mailbox will have it stamped with one CAS server. And in fact, it'll be the same CAS server. It'll be the first CAS that you introduce into that site. What that means then, without the array and without a load balancer, every single Outlook client would go to the same CAS server at all times. You don't want that to happen because if that CAS server goes away, nobody can connect to their mailboxes. So you want to prevent that from happening by deploying multiple CAS servers, creating a CAS array, and load balancing in front of them. If you don't do that, you won't have high availability because this is the client connection endpoint. And if you don't have high availability for that endpoint, clients won't be able to connect to their mailboxes. So it's very important that you make that array and get the property stamped. Now, the good news is, after the array is created, any mailbox databases that you create will automatically get stamped with the value of the array. Until you create that array, though, all the mailboxes are going to get stamped with the name of an individual CAS server. So generally, because CAS is the first server role that we want you to deploy, after you've deployed CAS, the very first thing you're going to do is create the RPC Client Access Array. So as soon as you deploy your first mailbox server, all of your mailbox databases will be stamped with that property pointing to the array and not to an individual CAS server. So that makes things much, much easier. If you do have a bunch of existing databases, you just need to reconfigure them using set mailbox database and populate the value of the RPC Client Access Server with the name of your CAS array. So any databases that existed before you created the array, you'll have to fix that manually yourself. But if you create the array before you create any databases, then all of that work is done for you automatically. Okay, let's talk about storage. But I'll tell you, though, we're only going to talk a little bit about storage. We could actually spend hours and hours talking about storage design, storage options, storage troubleshooting, and so forth for Exchange. In fact, sometimes we even have entire tech ed sessions that are devoted to them. But this is really just going to summarize our best practices here. Generally, as with every Exchange solution, you want to isolate your storage. And that means a database and its log stream should be isolated from every other database and every other log stream. Okay, you don't want to share storage because if that storage goes away, it could take out multiple databases and increase your outage. The other thing is we now give you more options with respect to storage. You don't have to use an expensive storage area network. Direct attached storage became prime time in Exchange 2007 and continues to be a very viable option in Exchange 2010. The other thing is you don't necessarily need to use RAID anymore. You could use a JBOD configuration. And again, JBOD, just a bunch of disks, non-RAID, which generally means a database and its log stream on one disk that's not protected with RAID. In fact, typically what we're talking about is a 7200 RPM SATA disk, the same type of disk that's probably in every single one of your desktop PCs back at your offices. So those are the kind of disks that we're talking about. Very cheap, inexpensive, off-the-shelf commodity hardware. But the design point isn't something where you say, I want to deploy on JBOD, so I'm going to design a DAG that lets me do that. It's actually the reverse is what you want to do. You design the DAG solution first based on the failures you want to protect against. And if it turns out your design includes a sufficient number of database copies where JBOD is an option, then you can leverage JBOD. So don't design for JBOD. JBOD becomes an option only after you've designed for resiliency. And that can confuse some people because a lot of people see JBOD as an attractive option because it's so much lower cost. You don't want to just go for that if you don't have the operational maturity to operate a JBOD environment. And you do require a very high level of operational maturity when working in JBOD. If you're in a RAID array and you lose a disk, it's not a big deal. Nothing happens. The array keeps going. Maybe it's rebuilding itself, so it might be a little bit slower. But it doesn't directly affect the database. In a JBOD environment, if you lose a disk, that's a database failover every time. Because once that disk is gone, it takes the database with it, and we need to fail over to a passive copy at that point. So every JBOD failure ends up being the disk failover. And if you don't have the operational maturity to monitor for that and to take corrective action when that happens, then you could actually reduce availability by deploying JBOD versus increase availability by following our guidance. So keep that in mind as well. So generally, when we talk about the recommendations, if you've only got two highly available copies, you're going to be using RAID. Okay, that's not enough copies for you to go for a JBOD solution, for you to eliminate RAID. However, if you start increasing the number of copies, if you go to three or more highly available copies, now you have an option. Now you can choose RAID or JBOD, depending on what your needs are and what your costs are. Similarly, if you have one lagged copy, again, that point-in-time copy back there, that's not enough copies for you to get away without using RAID. So a single lag copy, you'd be using RAID for that. But if you deployed more than one lag copy, now you can, again, have the option of RAID or JBOD. So again, just restating this, as you can see, the option to go to JBOD comes into play only when you increase the number of copies that you're using. So that's something to be aware of. Don't do JBOD if you've only got two copies. That could put you in a very, very bad state. All right, let's talk about the networking now, too. Networking is important, but networking has also changed considerably in Exchange 2010. It's very different from the high availability platform we had previously. Generally, we do recommend redundancy throughout your network, but we no longer require that. In Exchange 2007 and earlier, we required two network cards in every highly available mailbox server. We don't require that anymore. In Exchange 2010, we only require one network card at each server. You do have the ability to add additional network cards if you want that redundancy, but we no longer require it. It's your choice at this point. It's your option. The other thing that you want to be aware of is our support stance has changed recently. We used to have a support boundary of 250 millisecond round-trip return latency between all DAG members. We've now increased that to 500 milliseconds, or half a second latency. That's very, very high latency. But the reason we did that, though, is we recognize that there are customers that have very highly latent networks, but they're able to successfully deploy a DAG on those networks because their transaction log volume is so low that it's not impacted by the highly latent network. Now, of course, if your transaction logs are just increasing and growing and you've got a lot of data that you're shipping across the wire, then you absolutely want to make sure that you've got as low a latency as possible. But the ceiling for the boundary has increased. It's now 500 milliseconds, a round-trip return latency between all DAG members, regardless of where they're geographically located. One other thing to keep in mind is replication, the log shipping, is always happening from the active copy to the passive copy. So if you have multiple passive copies of the same database, you've got multiple replication streams going from that one active copy to each of those passive copies. We always and only replicate logs from the active copy. We can seed from the passive copy, but we can only replicate from the active copy. Now, we have some new features built into the DAG. One of them is DAG compression. The other is DAG encryption. The success of the compression is going to be based largely on the format of your email messages. So for instance, if you're using a lot of HTML email, that's highly compressible. So using DAG compression would save you a lot of networking traffic. By contrast, if most of your email messages are composed in rich text format, that's not very compressible. And so the DAG compression wouldn't give you that much savings over the wire. Now in MSIT, inside of Microsoft, we see about a 30% savings in network traffic with compression enabled. And we've got a pretty healthy mix of HTML and RTF, rich text format mail messages, but every organization is going to be different. Every organization will have different quantities of HTML email and different quantities of RTF email. So generally what we would recommend is leave DAG compression turned on, and then see if you get any savings over the wire as a result of that. Now, for those of you who may already be using WAN compression technology, like Riverbed, for example, Riverbed or other WAN compression technologies cannot be used with DAG compression. Okay, you can only compress something once. Once it's compressed, you can't compress it again. So you really only want to use one compression engine. And if you've already invested in a third-party WAN accelerator or WAN compressor, continue using that one as long as it's transparent to Exchange. If you haven't invested in one yet, simply use the built-in features that we have and use the built-in DAG compression for that. Some other things that have added in Service Pack 1, we've added a second form of continuous replication. It's called block mode continuous replication. So that's actually a benefit. That actually reduces exposure on the log drive for the active copy. It eliminates the transaction log file for a database from being a single point of failure in this solution. And we'll talk about file mode and block mode in the deep dive session that's coming up next. And some other things you want to be aware of with respect to DAG networks, and these can throw some people off. So the first thing I want to talk about is what to do with iSCSI networks. So with an iSCSI network, that's your storage network. That should not be used for client traffic. It should not be used for replication traffic. It should not be used for management or backup traffic. It should be isolated to the storage solution. It should be dedicated to that iSCSI disk. And what happens, though, is if you are using iSCSI storage and you add a mailbox server to a DAG, those iSCSI networks will get detected by the DAG, and the DAG will start trying to use them. You don't want that to happen. The DAG should not use them for replication. They should be isolated to the underlying subsystem, storage subsystem. So what you have to do is you have to run this command, and you're basically ignoring that network. You're telling the DAG, yes, I know you see these iSCSI networks out here, but I want you to ignore them. Don't use them for any purpose. Once you've done that, the iSCSI networks will still appear, but they will no longer be used by the DAG itself. They'll only be used by the underlying storage system as you've configured them to be. The other thing is this task that you have to do to block this cross network heartbeat traffic. So how many of you have ever configured a dedicated heartbeat network in a cluster? Okay. A few hands went up. Okay. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but there is no such thing as a heartbeat network in a cluster. Okay, I'll let that just linger for a moment. And now I'll repeat it. There is no such thing as a heartbeat network in a cluster. And there never has been. Ever, ever, ever. Why? Because in Windows failover clustering, all networks are heartbeated. Okay, there's no such thing as a heartbeat network. It doesn't exist and never has. People talk about it all the time, but they don't exist. If you go look in TechNet, search as far back all the way to the NT4.0 days when we first introduced Windows failover clustering, we don't have any documentation that talks about a heartbeat network because they don't exist. The reason for that is all of these interfaces are heartbeated. And that actually can become a problem. It can become a problem for a couple reasons. First, up here, you're seeing a representation of a four-node DAG. Each one of these squares is representing a server, and the server that has a MAPI network and a replication network, two network cards in them. Because all networks are heartbeated, that means Windows failover clustering wants to send heartbeats from the MAPI network here to the MAPI network here, into the MAPI network here, and the MAPI network here. But it also wants to send heartbeats from this MAPI network to this replication interface, and this one, and this one. Now imagine if this were 16 members instead of 4 members. And imagine if each of these had, say for instance, 3 network cards instead of 2 network cards. That is a lot of heartbeat traffic. So much so that it could end up overwhelming your network. The other reason that you want to block heartbeat traffic is it diminishes the system's ability to distinguish between a network and a server failure. Say, for instance, this server's having a problem down here, but this one's trying to heartbeat it. If we lose a network interface, but it still has the ability to heartbeat the other network interface, it says, yeah, I can talk to it, life is good, I don't need to take failover action. But the reality is, if this interface is down, this is the MAPI network, no clients can connect to that server anymore. So the fact that it can be heartbeated doesn't mean it's up and available. It's still down from the user's perspective because the MAPI interface is down. So the solution that you have to do is you have to block that crosstalk. You want to block, for instance, this network from heartbeating this network. You should only be able to heartbeat the other MAPI networks from a MAPI network. You should only be able to heartbeat these other replication networks from a replication network. Do not allow the MAPI interface on one server to heartbeat the replication interface on the other servers. Do not allow a replication interface on one server to heartbeat other replication interfaces on other servers. So there's a couple different ways that you can block this traffic. One is to use router ACLs. If your router supports the ACLing or the securing of traffic or the blocking of traffic, you can block it at the router level. Another way to do it is to use the Windows NetSH command and use that to configure your traffic paths as well. But either way, you want to block this cross-network heartbeat crosstalk because, as I said, it could overwhelm your network with heartbeat activity and it diminishes the system's ability to distinguish between a server and a network failure. Okay? So again, keep that in mind. Go back to your offices, impress your friends by telling them you know something about heartbeat networks that they don't know, that they don't exist, and then you can fool them into thinking that they didn't know that already. Okay. There's actually a lot more to DAG networks than what we're talking about here as well. So hopefully you'll come to the deep dive session that's after this one where we'll talk about how the DAG networks are actually created and how you would deal with them. But these are important from a design standpoint from both iSCSI and the heartbeating perspective. Okay, the last area I want to talk about are DAG member policies. And these are basically policy settings that you can apply to your DAG members to control their behavior. Because there are some scenarios in which you would want to control what a DAG member does, whether or not it can activate mailbox databases and so forth. So the first policy is this database copy auto activation policy. Okay, so when a failure occurs that affects an active copy of a database, the system needs to take corrective action and it needs to activate a passive copy and turn that passive copy into an active copy. But you may have copies of your databases that you don't want the system to activate automatically. Okay, so what you can do is you can block that. You can use the set mailbox server cmdlet and you can set it to one of these two values. Blocked means under no circumstances will the system automatically activate it. Okay? If that database needed to be used, it would be up to an administrator to manually activate that database. The other setting, intra-site only, is for extended DAGs, DAGs extended across multiple Active Directory sites. That setting is there so that you can say, don't activate copies of this database unless the active copy failed in this local site. Okay, so I've got multiple sites, I have an active copy that failed, I only want to activate another copy of that database in the same site of the failed database. I don't want the system to activate a database that's in another AD site. That is what intra-site only means. And of course, the default setting, which is how it normally runs, is unrestricted. Out of the box, the default setting is all database copies can be activated by the system at any time. So what are the scenarios in which you might want to do this? Well, see, you did have a second data center, and you deployed DAG members to that data center, and you've got mailbox database copies over there, but your data center is intended for disaster recovery purposes only, not high availability. So you want control over that. You want manual control over the activation of the databases in your disaster recovery data center. And so you would put a block on it. You would set the block to intra-site only, so that databases within the local site could still be activated, but if there were a failure, none of the databases in the remote disaster recovery data center would be activated. It would be up to the administrator to manually do that when the time comes. And of course, blocked is a condition that you would do when you're typically doing maintenance on a server. So if I need to do Windows update or some hardware maintenance on a server, I'm going to block activation on that server because it's going to be up and running, but I don't want it to suddenly host active database copies because I may be rebooting it several times during my maintenance window. So in a maintenance scenario, you would probably take the entire server and set it to blocked. And we, in fact, have a very nice script that we ship with Exchange SP1 that will do that for you. It's called start DAG server maintenance.ps1, and that can be used to put a DAG member into maintenance mode. And when a DAG member is in maintenance mode, one of the first things it does is it gets blocked from auto activation. Okay, another policy that we have is the maximum active databases. And what this setting does, it allows you to put a limit on the number of active databases that can be hosted on this mailbox server, whichever mailbox server you set it on. So we all know that the standard edition of Exchange supports 5 databases. The enterprise edition supports 100 databases. But let's say that you were running the enterprise edition, but you didn't have enough resources to actually support up to 100 databases on that particular server. Maybe you only have enough resources to support 30 databases or 40 databases, for example. And so what you can do is you can set this property that with set mailbox server, it's called the max active databases property. You set that to a numeric value, and that numeric value is the maximum number of databases that you will allow to be mounted and active on that server at any given time. And what happens is, if the system is trying to activate a copy, it looks at servers to see if they have limits on them. And if the server has reached its limit, it's going to try a different server for activation instead. So this was actually a feature that we put in there because MSIT in particular wanted to limit the number of databases that they had running on any given server at any given time. Okay, so now you have the benefit of doing the same thing. Not everybody's going to want to limit it, and in fact, you may not need to if you have few enough databases where a limit doesn't make sense. But if you do have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of databases, or certainly lots of active databases that could become active on a single server, you would absolutely want to maybe put a maximum cap on that server so that you don't overload a particular mailbox server and you can keep the system up and running at peak performance. All right. And with that, again, there is related content. We've got the high availability deep dive session coming up after this session in this room. I will tell you, it's a 400 level session, so it's very deep technical stuff, under the hood kind of stuff for the database availability group. So it's one of those things that can really hurt your brain after sitting there and hearing about it for an hour. A couple other things I mentioned. I noticed you guys taking notes, and that's great, and taking pictures and stuff. You will get all these slide decks. They will be posted to the TechEd website after the show's over, so you'll be able to download all these. And you may have noticed the cameraman following me as I pace back and forth. So this session's also being recorded, and you can download the recording as well. So that way, when you're in the sessions, you can just sort of relax and not have to worry about jotting down everything I say or taking pictures of every slide, because you're going to be able to get all this great content as well. Standard team resources for you. Don't forget your evals. And then, of course, here's all the contact info if you want to contact me at any time after the event. I will be at Ask the Experts after the HA Deep Dive session as well. So if you have any additional questions, we can talk about it. But the HA Deep Dive session is in here in this room in about 30 minutes or so. I'm just going to hang out here the whole time. So if you do have questions and you want to hang out and chat with me, I'm more than happy to do that as well. So again, please don't forget to fill out your evals. Your feedback's very important and very appreciated. And with that, thanks for attending this session.